In the name of the God above, Christ beside, and the Spirit within. Amen. On August 28, 1963, 250,000 people marched on Washington protesting unequal treatment of blacks compared to whites when it comes to economic and social rights. Here's part of the speech they heard that day. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a desert state sweltering with the heat of injustice and oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. I have a dream today. This is the faith I will go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together. Knowing that we will be free one day, I have a dream. And when this happens, we will be able to speed up that day when all God's children, black and white, Jew and Gentile, Protestant and Catholic, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old spiritual, free at last. Free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last. Many of you will recognize this speech. It was delivered by Martin Luther King Jr., the acclaimed leader of the Black Civil Rights Movement. And King, you know, is being frequently quoted in protests taking place right now. And it's so sad, isn't it? So sad that even as so much has changed, too much has stayed the same when it comes to the inequality of treatment and abuse, as we've been seeing in the news all the time, abuse and opportunities, you know, between blacks compared to whites. And so, how do we cope? How do we cope when there seems to be such a mountain to climb, such a wall to knock down, such a bridge to build to get to the other side of change? How do we cope? How do we cope when we're discouraged, dismayed, overwhelmed by the enormity of the obstacles and so threatened by the viciousness of the resistance to change in some quarters? How do we cope? You know, this is a personal question for us in our own lives as much as it's a question for us as allies or black persons ourselves. All of us must put ourselves into the shoes of a black person or also in this country, an indigenous person today. We must put ourselves in those shoes. How do we find hope where God is concerned? What kind of faith do we need to cultivate? Let's seek out some revelatory guidance from our scriptures. To discern revelation in the story we're given, we need to listen to the witness of the slave woman Hagar. Even though this story is part of the larger story of the patriarchs and matriarchs of that first generation of Israelites, you know, Abraham and Sarah, You know, they're anything but stellar in their integrity before God. In fact, this story, their story, is a story about the grace of God to sinners, of which Abraham and Sarah are definitely representative. Now, to be fair, this is a world also that is patriarchal. That means men rule. You know, and Sarah is a strong personality, and Abraham does have to accede to her wishes all too often in order to find his own peace. But of course, Sarah herself is, as a woman, is treated in a certain way, and so she carries her own wounds in all this. And this is also a time where men have multiple wives, you know, and this is intended to help populate the tribe. And it is also a time where there are slaves, and the heroine of our story, Hagar, is a slave. Now, the beautiful thing about this story, though, is firstly that the Muslim faith traces its roots to Hagar and her son, Ishmael. This is why Abraham is seen as a patriarch of Islam, as much as he's the patriarch of the Jews and also Christianity that stems from Judaism. But whereas the Jewish people trace their roots from Abraham's son, Isaac, Muslims trace their roots from Abraham's son, Ishmael. And even as Hagar is a mere slave, she rises up to become a powerful matriarch of a whole peoples, the Arab peoples, as it's shown here in the scriptures. Now, second, Hagar is seen as a heroine for black people, and especially black women. Why? Because she is a slave woman. With a history of black slavery, a woman like Hagar, who is treated as a mere womb to bear a child for the slave owner, sexually exploited and then discarded, and who is visited by God in her distress and destitution, she is a major figure of hope. She encounters God, and God reveals God's self to her. And this encounter and revelation are so personal that she, Hagar, gives God her own secret name, just hers. Now, to understand how incredible this is, let's compare Hagar's relationship with God to that of Abraham. Abraham doesn't name God himself. God gives God's name to Abraham. It's an act of intimacy, you know, to be given that name, to be, for this to be revealed. It's an act of intimacy, but it also reveals that God is the one to whom Abraham must ultimately submit. You know, God is El. That's the name given. God is El to Abraham. Only later in the story, generations later, when Moses comes on the scene and there's the burning bush, does God reveal God's self with an enhanced name built on El, Yahweh. Now, but in Hagar's case, she is permitted to name God with her own name for God. And that's what we receive in the story. She names God Elroy. Now, the only other story in the Bible we have where humans are given the privilege of naming other creatures is in, and these are other creatures, not God, but other creatures, is in the creation story where humans name all the animals. It's a sign of privilege and status to be given the authority to name other life God has created. Imagine the privilege and the status of naming God with your own personal name and God in the story receiving this. You know, Hagar, the slave woman, is given the privilege no other human is given. Wow. May we not miss this profound detail in the stories. And so black feminist literature and theology, called womanist theology, recognizes in Hagar a matriarch and a queen who has much to teach us about what it means to suffer and to encounter God in a personal way in our suffering, and then to turn that suffering into strength and vision and determination that will rise up into freedom and new life. Okay, how so? How does this happen? Let us dig into our story a little more. There are two times we're told Hagar is in major distress. The first time, she runs away from her mistress Sarah. Why? Well, she's treated harshly. Why? Well, Sarah can't get pregnant, and so she comes up with a plan because she cannot trust God. God is taking too long to give her a child, and so she has to take matters into her own hands, even if that means abusing someone else and mistreating them. She will have Hagar impregnated by Abraham, and then she will claim the child of the slave woman as her own. Now, any of you who have read or seen Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale will have a picture of what this means. You know, Abraham, he's willing to go with Sarah's plan. Of course, no one asks Hagar what she wants. She's just a body to be used for the master's purposes. And in the story, we're told God is profoundly, profoundly upset by this. He's upset profoundly with Abraham and Sarah. Now, Hagar is also vulnerable to the abuse of her master. She's vulnerable to the abuse of them. First, it's when she gets pregnant. Sarah resents it deeply. As much as she wants to claim this future child as her own, she resents, you know, with the true mother of the child still present, Hagar is around. It's hard to ignore the truth that she herself, Sarah, is barren. And so this resentment turns into abuse. Grief into her own situation turns into resentment and then abuse of Hagar. And then when Isaac is finally born, Sarah resents having Ishmael there. You know, Isaac is Sarah's son and he's born after Ishmael has already been born. He, that is Ishmael, must not claim the inheritance as the eldest son would and take that away from Isaac. And so Hagar pays the price by being further mistreated. And the first time Hagar, you know, when she's pregnant, she runs away when she's pregnant. She's got nothing and she's all alone. But that's when she first meets God. You know, God reveals God's self to her in her affliction, we're told. And Hagar finds new strength somehow to come back to and survive. And her resilience is built on the very personal name she develops with Elroy, her own secret name for God, Elroy. Now the second time she runs away, well, she doesn't run away. Hagar is actually thrown out. Abraham takes her, you know, on a long journey far away with young Ishmael. He gives them some supplies, hardly enough to survive. And then he abandons them. All alone, ready to die, somehow Hagar finds the strength to care for her son and herself. And it's because her God is right there with her when she is destitute and alone, and she leaves Ishmael alone because she can't bear to see him die. He's just a child. And somehow God comes to her. She feels God, that energy, and she kind of rises up. And Hagar and Ishmael not only survive, Ishmael becomes a great man, very successful, and the father of a whole peoples. And Hagar is that matriarch who raises him and feeds him with her strength and her relationship with Elroy. You know, she feeds him and nurtures him, not just physically taking care of him or mentally, but also feeding him spiritually with her own personal faith with Elroy God. What an amazing story. No wonder it has been such a story of revelatory inspiration and hope for black slaves and for Muslims, among others. And this brings it back to Martin Luther King Jr. You know, there's a powerful account of one of the many times King felt he was on the verge of falling apart. You know, he couldn't take it anymore. He was rarely ever alone. He was always surrounded by people, always having to talk to people. And the civil rights movement for greater freedom and equality of blacks in America, it was ever expanding, and the pressure was mounting to deliver, you know, the personal questions and doubts, though, about his own ability to deliver, to lead, you know, to represent the hopes and dreams of his people in the face of serious opposition and criticism. This pressure, it was just mounting to the breaking point. And he felt all alone, and he talks. I mean, sure, there was lots of support around him, but he was the one who had to deliver, and people were depending on him. But he also had many enemies. You know, many wanted to see him fall. And one night he tells the story. King tells this story. One night after everyone was in bed, you know, the phone rang. Someone spoke on the other end. He cursed and he threatened King. And if he didn't stop, he would be dead and his family would suffer. And King hung up the phone. And he said he began to sweat profusely. Was he having a nervous breakdown? He tried to pray. His preacher father wasn't around for support. His wife was in bed. He was all alone. He said he cried up to God. Before that moment, God had never been that personal for him. He knew about God. He had taught about God. He had preached great sermons. You know, he had a doctorate in theology, but God had not been that personal presence and power in his inner life. Now it all changed, he says, that night. King experienced God's powerful presence, speaking to him words of encouragement, strengthening him. And he says his relationship to God changed that very night. You know, King met God like Hagar had thousands of years earlier. What name did King give God? You know, that personal way. Was God Elroy to him? Whatever it was, both Hagar and King, they teach us that unless faith in God becomes personal, especially in times of challenge and difficulty and struggle, if it doesn't become personal, you know, it will not be enough. Making faith personal, you know, it doesn't resolve anything on the outside, you know, but it may be just the kind of inner door that may give us what we need to make it through and become the empowered human beings that is in us to become. We need to find that inner voice that cries up to God again and again in times of life, and we need to feel that divine energy flow in and through us. We do. Whether our hopes and dreams are in the Black Lives Matter movement, effecting concrete change this time around, and ongoing protests and concrete recommendations for change, whether we join with Indigenous peoples of this territory we call Canada in their struggle for equal rights, respect, and self-determination, whether it's the resilience we need to live through this time of COVID-19 and learning some important life lessons, whether our personal challenges and struggles also come in different ways that are specific to us in terms of what we're going through right now. What Hagar and King teach us is that unless our relationship to God becomes personal, we will find little strength, inspiration, courage, and grace to get to the promised land. May you and I be visited by this God of ours as Hagar and King were visited. May God reveal God's self to us in a special way, personal to us. May we too perhaps find our own name for God, the way we have personal names for those closest to us. God is seeking that